we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to Animal Voices, Western Canada's only radio program dedicated to animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, unceded Coast Salish territories. Today is Friday, August 4th, 2017. I'm your host, Elise Jacobson, and I'm joined here in the studio today by my co-host, Jillian Walters.
Hello.
And our guest control room operators, Amira Lee.
Hey.
And Jody Pongratz. Welcome, everyone. Today's show will be focused on a very large group of animals who are often overlooked, and those are invertebrates, particularly insects and crustaceans. Despite making up roughly 97% of all animals on Earth, invertebrates often tend to get ignored in animal rights advocacy. There's been some fascinating research in recent years into their rather unexpected emotional and social lives. In about 15 minutes, we'll be discussing some of these findings, sharing stories about some of our own experiences with various invertebrate animals, and sharing some ideas around how we can potentially be better friends and advocates for them. Our feature interview will be with Dr. James Traniello, a professor of biology at Boston University, who has devoted the last 40 years of his life to the study of ants. He'll share with us some of his own research findings on these incredible tiny creatures, as well as his insights on what ant behavior can teach us about human social psychology. That's coming up in just over half an hour, so stay tuned. But first, sorry about that. We're having a little feedback on the line there.
I think it's actually somebody drilling outside or something.
Oh, like dear. Okay. Studio's under construction, we're going to say. But before we get started, Jillian, I just wanted to ask you about your recent experience visiting Rasta Farm Sanctuary in Shemanis, B.C. Tell us about that.
Oh, I was so excited to go there after listening to that interview that Sinead did with Lucy. And so I visited the sanctuary, and I was blown away by Lucy's ability to really educate on factory farming, and the place is really getting established. It needs more work, so more volunteers are needed, compassionate and reliable volunteers they're looking for, as well as donations are always welcome. I also met a little pig called Penny, and I just fell in love with her. She is, oh, I can't even describe it. She's so sweet. Her story was she fell off a truck, I think it was in Alberta, and the car behind the truck picked the little piggy up and took her to the vet and stayed with the family for a few weeks. Nobody wanted to adopt her that didn't want to eat her. So, yeah, so Rasta stepped in, and little Penny took a flight to Shemanis, and she's now there trying to make friends. And it's so cute because just watching her, she's like a puppy.
Aww.
Same kind of behaviors as a puppy.
Pigs often are like puppies. They wag their tails and they're happy, right? And yeah, so cute. Oh, that's amazing. I'd really love to visit there someday. We did just have Lucy, the founder and director of the sanctuary, on the show a few weeks ago doing an interview, and that was great, telling us all about the animals that she has there.
And you can, she's got special visiting hours, so you just need to, because they're so busy there, you just email her and make an appointment to go see her.
Yeah. And you can do that through their website, right?
Yes.
The Rasta Sanctuary website. Yeah, that's fantastic. Very cool. And then there's also been some stuff in the news recently, at least in the vegan world, about a very popular brand of vegan cheese, right?
Can you tell us about that? Drama.
Yeah.
Yes, that's what they're calling it. I was a little shocked at first. I think most vegans were at first because well, for me, I feel dedicated to, you know, supporting a vegan business. And then all of a sudden you find out they sell to a huge corporation that tests on animals. So immediately before really thinking about it, I was like, okay, I'm going to boycott. That's it.
Yeah.
But I think there's a lot more. Once I took the time to read, there's a lot more to know about. I mean, and you can say a bit more on that.
Well, yeah, just to be clear for any listeners who don't know, the Daiya Cheese Company has been a pretty small company. They were actually based in Vancouver, and they just recently decided to, I guess, essentially sell the company to a Japanese corporation called Otsuka.
Yes.
Right? And Otsuka is like a biomedical corporation. So, yeah, they do, part of their business involves conducting animal tests. And so, yeah, obviously a lot of vegans have been up in arms about this. But there has been a fair amount of controversy even within the vegan community. Some, like you said, are saying to boycott and others saying not to. And I think that obviously it's a complicated issue. You know, we don't want to be, as vegans, we don't want to be supporting animal mm-hmm. testing in any way. At the same time, it's kind of like it becomes, the waters become a little muddy, like in terms of where we draw the line. You know, there's so many vegan products, even products that we buy at the store, you know, like every store we shop at sells animal products as well, and we're kind of, you know, feeding money into that. And so
I think it's great that people are at least being vocal about it, though, because I think if anything it might apply pressure to this Otsuka founding company to maybe change their ways, because I'm sure they're going to get a bit of the fallout as well from how vocal people have been about it. So
right, absolutely.
There was an interesting quote by the Vegan Action, who certifies Daiya. They do the certification for products that are vegan. They said, "We do indeed still consider Daiya vegan. The product line brand is all vegan, does not contain any animal products, and is not tested on animals. That's the criteria we use. If we didn't allow companies that are owned by parent companies to apply for and use the certified vegan logo, there wouldn't be any certified vegan products."
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty telling, and it's true. Yeah. It makes sense, obviously. So, yeah, I am of two minds about it. Obviously, I think, Amir, you're absolutely right. It's important to apply pressure to mm-hmm. companies like this and, you know, make our voices heard and not be complacent about this kind of thing. And at the same time, we sort of have to accept that we live in a non-vegan world, so mm-hmm. being vegan just means doing the very best we can, right? Daiya itself is still vegan. Like you said, they're not going to be adding any animal products mm-hmm. to the product or, you know, testing on animals themselves or anything. And I guess Daiya will remain an independent subsidiary, as far as I understand. And it's just, Otsuka is sort of the parent company. And it's, I mean, that kind of speaks to the whole, you know, the issue of corporatism and capitalism and that kind of thing. You know, mm-hmm. we just live in a world where a small number of corporations pretty much own everything. So
that's right.
You know, what are you going to do?
I think it also speaks to the need of having an alternative vegan cheese that's in the mainstream, because Daiya is used like everywhere. It's used at pizza places and stuff mm-hmm. like that. It'd be cool to have other options to.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree. I think it'd be great to see more. And there are other companies, mm-hmm. you know, like Follow Your Heart and that sort of mm-hmm. thing, who are making vegan cheeses. They just don't have the kind of reach that Daiya seems to have, right?
No.
Like, you're right, you find Daiya everywhere nowadays. Mm-hmm. Even small neighborhood pizza shops are starting to use it and that sort of thing. So, yeah, absolutely. I think it's there's a lot to think about there. But maybe if for our listeners, if you have thoughts about this, feel free to send us emails, comment on our Facebook page, tweet at us, let us know what you think.
Howdy, folks. Tune in every Sunday afternoon from 4 to 5:30 for What the Folk. Singer-songwriters, deep folk, roots music. It's all folk music. Sundays from 4 to 5:30 p.m. right here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM and www.cooperadio.org.
For local events. On Saturday, tomorrow, August 5th from 9 to 11 at the northeast corner of Hastings Street and Commercial, Vancouver Chicken Save hosts the weekly chicken vigil at the Hallmark Chicken Slaughterhouse. Please join us in bearing witness and spreading the message of kindness and compassion. On Sunday, August 6th at 6 p.m., meet Dave Paco, author and musician from San Diego. This is a potluck event promotion tour for his vegan cookbook. the bodyguard, travel companion, a vegan food guide for Mexico and Central America.
That's exciting.
It is. I know, my mouth's watering. I'm like,
Yeah.
Yeah, so the location has not been put out there, so if you can go to meetup.com.
Cool, and this is a Vancouver Meatless Meetup that's putting it on, or Meetup Vancouver?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. And sorry, what was the guy's name?
It is Dave Paco, and I hope I'm pronouncing that right.
Cool. So he's been traveling around in Mexico and Central America, and...
Yeah, so he's going to, and I think he's even going to be bringing a dish to the potluck. So you get to taste his food and hear about his book.
That's great. Wow, very cool.
On Friday, August 25th at 7 p.m., Professor John Gluck, a former primate scientist, will be giving a talk on his recent memoir, Voracious Science and Vulnerable Animals, A Primate Scientist's Ethical Journey. This is super exciting. This scientist has done harm to animals, to primates in his work, and now he abhors testing on animals. So this is going to be really exciting to hear his take on it.
Yeah,
this memoir.
That is fascinating. That's really cool. And that's on August 25th.
Yeah, right? At 7 p.m. And there'll be a Q&A to follow the session.
Very cool. Yeah, I'm always really interested to hear from people in those types of situations, you know, people who have made a living exploiting animals or harming animals, and who kind of then had a change of heart and are advocating for not harming animals.
Exactly. Those are my favorites.
Yeah. Yeah, they really have a very special insight, I think.
And that's going to be at the UBC downtown at Robson Square.
Okay, great. So moving on, I just wanted to talk a little bit about invertebrates today, since that is the theme of our show. Obviously, again, like I said earlier, invertebrates make up roughly 97% of all animals on this planet, which is sort of mind-boggling. Obviously, there are trillions and trillions of them on Earth. And but again, they don't tend to get a whole lot of attention in mainstream animal advocacy. I think there are a lot of reasons for that, probably the main one being that they're often not very cute or cuddly, and so people don't really relate to them, or, you know, necessarily even want to be around them, because, you know, invertebrates include a lot of, you know, creepy crawlies that kind of scare people. So, but yeah, there's been a lot of really interesting research in recent years. You know, I was looking some things up online, and yeah, I think they're a lot more complex than was previously thought. For example, there have been studies done on pain perception in prawns and crabs. This is kind of led by Dr. Robert Elwood and his colleagues at Queen's University Belfast. They've actually spent years researching crustaceans and have conducted several different studies on pain perception in different species. Starting with prawns, Dr. Elwood thought that he knew what to expect with the prawns because, you know, he thought, oh, of course, I'll see nothing more than reflex reactions to any sort of stimuli. But what the researchers did was they brushed acetic acid onto the antennae of the prawns. And what happened was these prawns began to groom the treated antennae with complex, prolonged movements of both front legs. And the grooming diminished when local anesthetic was applied before the acetic acid. So that indicated that they were feeling some kind of a pain response. Yeah, they also did studies with, you know, a mild electric shock to hermit crabs and that sort of thing. And they noticed that the crabs would rub that spot for extended periods with their claws. And yeah, there were a lot of reactions that that indicated that they were feeling something. And it was beyond just reflexes in every case. Yeah, really, really interesting stuff. There was another study done about anxiety in crayfish. Some researchers in France did a study on crayfish. They exploited the fact that crayfish are more comfortable in the dark. So they kind of had them in a dark environment. And after they gave the crayfish mild electric shocks, they placed them in an aquarium maze. And the crayfish, given the electric shocks, were reluctant to enter the lit areas of the maze, the ones that were not shocked, you know, explored all the areas. But then what they did, and this was really interesting, they gave them an anti-anxiety drug that is used to treat anxiety in humans. And the symptoms of anxiety that these crayfish were showing about going into lit areas went away when they were given the anxiety drugs. They just explored every area of the maze. And they concluded from that you know, the lobsters were feeling some kind of a reaction that was beyond pain. They were actually anxious about experiencing further pain. So
what's especially troubling about the first point you brought up about crabs and prawns and that kind of thing is when people actually consume these animals, it's only considered that they're the freshest when they're alive. And
right.
I'm thinking about how they experience pain, you know, it's just, it's almost horrifying how people treat these animals.
Absolutely. Yeah. They're often boiled alive and that sort of thing. And which is so horrifying. I remember reading a while back too, that, lobsters apparently don't experience shock. So, you know, for example, when, most animals, you know, especially mammals and including humans, when we experience a great deal of pain, quite often we'll go into shock as a coping mechanism. But I guess lobsters don't have that that response in their bodies, so they just suffer right up until the moment that they die, which is really, really sad to me. And apparently scientists have found that it can take lobsters between 35 and 45 seconds to die when they are plunged into a pot of boiling water. And if they're dismembered, their nervous system can still function for up to an hour.
That is so sad.
Yeah.
And we're so disconnected. I mean, we're so disconnected from that, most people.
Right, yeah. For sure. I know, it's the type of thing that most people don't think about. I think, again, it's like, I feel like quite often we're not, at the very least, we're not taught to relate to these animals mm-hmm. as other beings. And again, I think there's widely been a perception that they don't feel pain, that they don't really, you know, that they're very simple creatures. They don't really think or anything. So, and obviously they, you know, their nervous systems and their brains are not as complex as, say, mammals or birds, but they still do have some of these functions that indicate that they can feel and that they do suffer. So, yeah, it is very sad, but I think it's enlightening. I think it's good to, you know, be talking about this and raising awareness about it.
Oh, for sure. Education is key, right?
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, and Amir, like you said, it's just the way that when these animals are bought, they often are alive and they're, you know, killed. People kill them at home and that kind of thing.
I come from a family, actually, that consumes a lot of crab and shellfish, and it's unfortunate, obviously, but there's people out there that actually discard dead crabs and lobsters because they aren't alive, and they won't even use them because, again, it's considered that they're not as fresh as they can be.
Right, yeah.
Which is disgusting to me, obviously.
But. Yeah. It is a big thing around here, too, being that we live on a coast. You know, I think there's people eat a lot of sea animals here, and I was actually just recently playing a concert in West Vancouver, and I was out at the kind of the dock out there, and I saw people catching crabs and throwing them up onto the dock, and these poor things are on their backs and kind of, you know, they're alive and obviously just, you know, stressed out, and so yeah, very sad. Insects are another one that are, you know, again, I think people tend to not think too much about insects and, you know, what they're capable of or what they feel and that sort of thing. But I found a really interesting study on honeybees that was published in the journal Current Biology in 2011. And these researchers found that agitated honeybees exhibit pessimistic cognitive biases, just like mammals, including humans and birds. What happened was the researchers shook the bees in a way that simulated a predatory attack, and they found that the bees were then more likely to classify ambiguous stimuli as predicting punishment. And the shaken bees also had lower levels of, I guess they tested the chemicals in their brains, and they had lower levels of dopamine, octopamine, and serotonin after this. And the conclusion that the researchers came to was that the honeybees could be regarded as exhibiting emotions, which is fascinating to me. I never would have thought of, you know, bees as having necessarily different emotional states. I guess we do talk about, you know, people commonly talk about bees being angry, you know, if you like hit their hive, they're angry and that sort of thing. But it's kind of, I don't know, just thinking about them being pessimistic, that's sort of on another level.
Oh, totally.
That's so interesting. When you think of, like, the wasp, like, when you're talking about cute animals, like, the bumblebee I find is so cute because it's, like, round and a little bit fuzzy.
Yeah.
But then you look at the wasp, and it's just interesting how you... I mean, for me, I just relate differently.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, me too. Absolutely. Yeah. And there's, I mean, yeah, I think there's just, you know, automatically we have different responses to different animals. And it's not necessarily bad. I think it's just something that we should think about and, you know, just be aware of our own cognitive biases. Just like me.
And I wonder how much of that has been, like, subconsciously learned as children, you know, and we react based on how other people are reacting to these creatures, and maybe somebody that you saw getting really scared or talking about it a certain way, you just learn to treat it that way as well.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's absolutely a factor for a lot of us, for sure. And I think, you know, and we are taught as kids that certain animals are dangerous, you know, like, oh, don't touch that, don't go near that animal because they'll bite you or whatever. I think that affects our perceptions of it a lot too.
And then we were talking about it before the show a little bit, but like there's movies and stuff, like I'm sure there's a million movies about like Attack of the Killer Bees, and obviously that subconsciously affects us and our perceptions as well a bit.
Arachnophobia.
Oh my god. Yeah. I don't even get started on arachnophobia.
Yeah,
I think Arachnophobia is actually the movie that made me scared of spiders initially,
because
I watched it when I was like 7 years old, and no 7 year old should be watching Arachnophobia.
Right. Speaking of which, we were talking a little bit about just personal experiences that we've had with various invertebrate animals. You had one that you shared, Jillian, that was really sweet, about a pet you had when you were a kid.
Yeah, her name was Sally, and she was an earthworm. She was out in the yard, and she just had a special spot, and I would visit her every day, and I was really excited to see her and pick her up and watch her squirm around in the dirt, and yeah, I really felt love for this little earthworm.
That's so cool. And so she just lived in your yard, and you always could find her in the same place. And that's really great.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah, I used to love watching and you know, kind of interacting with bugs in my yard when I was a little kid too. And there was actually this tree stump by our back fence that had sort of a strange, like, rounded outgrowth on it. And it was so funny. This little, like, round outgrowth had a little... It looked like a little house with a little chimney. And, and there were two colonies of ants that lived kind of in this stump. And I remember there was a colony of red ants and a colony of black ants. And when I was really young, even 5 years old, I would spend a lot of time out there just sitting there and watching them because I found them so fascinating. And I kind of learned a lot about them just by doing that, by observing the things they would do. And they would sometimes, you know, the colonies sort of lived alongside each other, but sometimes they'd have conflicts and I'd see them fight with each other. And you know, you could kind of see some of the different roles. Like, I remember I read when I was a kid that ant colonies typically keep, like, there's one ant who's designated as kind of the lookout, and they'll be sort of at the entrance of the colony, just sort of sitting there for long periods of time, you know, watching for intruders and that kind of thing. And I could see that when I was watching them. And and it was really special to me, a really memorable experience, just watching these creatures and feeling like, you know, when I was out there alone, just a little child, feeling like I was sort of part of their world. What about you, Amira? Do you have any?
Not like that, but you're talking about ants. They are super fascinating. I remember watching this video on YouTube, actually, where a bunch of researchers had discovered an abandoned ant colony. And what they did was they poured aluminum into the opening of, have you seen?
Right, yeah, I've heard about that.
And they unearthed this gigantic colony that looks like, honestly, it looks like a city, like a metropolis underground.
Wow.
So these ants have built this.
Yeah.
And we don't see any of that, obviously, but
that's
it was
true.
Cool for them to unearth that and show us that.
Yeah, it's so cool. They make these very complex colonies with different rooms.
So complex.
And
there's like highways and like areas. Yeah.
Yeah, each room kind of has its own purpose and that sort of thing. And yeah, it's pretty amazing. I think bees kind of do that to an extent as well. It's not exactly the same, I guess, but they, you know, have these societies where different individuals have different roles, and it's very social. And yeah, I've always been fascinated too, speaking of bees, about how they do those dances to show each other the nectar is.
I was thinking about that. I saw that on the Magic School Bus.
Oh, nice. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, it's so cool. I guess the depending on kind of what pattern they dance in, it shows the bees where the best flowers are.
Yeah.
And then apparently as soon as the bees watch another bee do this, they can immediately go to where the nectar is, which is crazy to me. Yeah, what else? Even recently, like, this is going to make me sound really weird, I think, but I live in an old house, and the bathroom has a window, which is sort of, you know, not something you see a ton nowadays, but in the window pane, the corner of the upper corner of the window pane, there was a spider recently, and I noticed that she had made an egg sac, and I thought, oh dear, what should I do? But then I thought, you know what? The window is open there. Like, the window kind of opens out. So I just said to myself, I'm just going to leave it there and see what happens, you know? So it was like weeks went by, and this mama spider just resolutely guarded her babies, didn't leave the entire time. And then one day she disappeared. I guess typically, you know, the mother spider will die, like, will go away and die before the babies are born, like, shortly before. And then a few days later I came home and there were a bunch of babies in the closet. And but you know, it was crazy because I kind of thought, they're gonna get everywhere, but they were very, like, sort of timid, you know, teeny, teeny, tiny little spiders, and they were very timid, and they really, like, stayed in their corner for several days. Maybe a couple of them sort of started to venture out after a while, but eventually they all just sort of, like, dropped out the window, and they all just went away. Like, it wasn't even an issue. No, I didn't have to do anything. I kind of thought, oh, I might have to, you know, catch one here and there, and which, you know, like, they're babies, I wasn't afraid of them, but yeah, but it was sort of amazing, actually. Like, I was sort of, I don't know how to describe it. I was sort of in awe of the mother spider being so dedicated to this, you know, like, how they just stay with the egg sac and protect it, and, you know, like, literally until the day they die. And then the babies come, and they just have to sort of, like, make it on their own. I don't know. I know, I'm a weirdo. It's just sort of cute.
You're not weird. You're not weird.
It's very brave of you. Having to watch a lot of videos in the last few years to get over my fear of spiders, which I've had since I was a kid.
Right.
And seeing them in the wild, like, in videos and stuff like that, definitely helps, because it shows you that they're not really these crazy aggressive things like arachnophobia would have shown.
Yeah, right, for sure.
Jumping at your face and stuff.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah,
they don't do that, usually.
Yeah, no, the vast majority of them, I think, are very shy, and they don't really want to, they definitely don't want to hurt you. Yeah, I find that I'm not really afraid of spiders typically until they get to a certain size. The real big ones kind of scare me a bit, which I'm still working on. I'm trying not to be too afraid of them. But
I thank my dad for developing a spider box. It was a bit, you know, those matchstick boxes? So you open it like so.
Yeah.
And so we'd get lots of those big, huge, big brown rain. I think they're called rain spiders. They come up through the bathtub. So you put the box on it and slide the bottom and then take it outside and empty it. So, and I noticed the funny thing is, I noticed on Facebook or something that they're actually selling, like, special spider lifters that you can pick up spiders and then put them outside.
Oh, you know what? I totally just bought one of those. You can get them at Canadian Tire. Yeah, seriously. It's not okay if I definitely don't want to hurt the spider, but, like, yeah, you then you don't have to touch them.
So maybe things are shifting.
Yeah. I know, it is sort of exciting to have an invention like that. Are we still okay here? Okay, good, yeah. Yeah, it's good to have something like that where you can just pick up the poor little bug without hurting them, for sure. Yeah, that's so cool. So your dad constructed this box himself?
He just used an empty matchstick box.
Yeah.
It's interesting what you learn when you're growing up from your parents, like, what an influence it is on how you treat, for example, in this case, insects. Like, with ants, it was a different story because my dad built the house and ants were invading the house from day one. So he's been at battle with these carpenter ants for, I don't know, 40 years.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. And that's tricky. I know we were talking a little bit before the show about kind of, you know, it can be tricky to know what to do in that kind of a situation if you are somebody who doesn't want to hurt these creatures, but at the same time, it's not really feasible to live with them, right?
Yeah.
Or to have them in your house, because it's true, they eat the wood, they'll destroy your home. So, I think quite often there are ways to kind of, at least there are preventative measures, right? Like ways that you can kind of close up holes or close up gaps or whatever to kind of keep them from coming in. And sometimes there are repellents that you can put out, you know, for various insects or various, you know, whatever, to at least sort of keep them away from the house. And, I think it's good to try to do that whenever possible. Do you have any thoughts on that? Any ideas about, or do you have any experiences? Like, have you ever successfully kind of kept?
I think it's moths use basil leaves.
Oh.
So we had a moth infestation at the place where I live in the cupboards.
Right.
So, yeah, you put basil leaves, or not, sorry, not, bay leaves, bay leaves.
Bay leaves, yeah. Right, yeah. Oh, cool.
So there are natural remedies you can find.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. I've heard that works with like weevils, for example, too. If you get weevils in your kind of your grains in your pantry and that kind of thing, you can put bay leaves or even, like, you know, dried chili peppers and stuff, and that'll repel them. And speaking of moths, I think there's other things that work too, like cedar blocks, you know, if you get moths in your closet or anything. And lavender, I think they aren't fond of lavender, so they'll go away. And for other bugs, things like ants and spiders and that kind of thing, I've heard that peppermint oil works pretty well if you kind of put peppermint around entrances where they might come in and that sort of thing, then they might stay out, which is good. Do you have any other thoughts on this, any other experiences to share?
Other than the more I know about a certain insect or animal, the more I fall in love with them, because they're so, I mean, like spiders, I really wasn't fond of spiders, and they still freak me out, but
yeah,
the more you know about them and how intricate they are, the more respect I have for them, and I just couldn't, I could not see myself stepping on a spider.
Yeah, that's a great point. No, I found the same thing, actually. Yeah, it's, you kind of, it's making me think of this quote that I always liked from Marie Curie. She said, "Nothing in life is to be feared. It is only to be understood." Right?
Oh, that's a great one.
Yeah. So it's like you're saying, if you understand something better, or you know more about it or someone, then, you know, it applies to so many areas of life. But you typically just are less afraid of it.
Yeah.
So that's really good. And I think, you definitely, you tend to have more, at least for me, I find I have more empathy for other creatures if I know more about them. Just like we were talking about before with the crustaceans, you know, people not empathizing with them. But I think we just need to know more about them, learn more about them, and consider their
feelings. And teach our young ones about them, because so many times I'm at the beach in the summer and I see kids doing awful things to crabs.
Right.
And their parents are right there often, and it's just, they're just not aware, I guess.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So teaching kids at a young age.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that, so many of us can have a role in that, even if we're not parents ourselves. You know, we can help out with any young people we know and be a good example.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
And be a good example to other adults, for that matter.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. All right, my guest today is Dr. James Traniello, a professor of biology and researcher at Boston University, who has dedicated nearly 40 years of his life to the study of ants. In that time, he has co-authored numerous research papers that have been published in various scientific journals. Hello, Dr. Traniello, and welcome to Animal Voices.
Hi, good afternoon.
So first of all, can you tell us a little bit about your work with ants? Which species do you tend to focus your research on, and what exactly about them are you studying?
Well, our major interest is related more to a concept than it is to ants directly. And that concept concerns the evolution of the social brain. And social brain theory is something that's largely been developed in reference to primates. And the notion is really that we need to explain the evolution of brain size and intelligence in humans. And humans are very interesting because we have brains that are disproportionately large in relationship to the size of our bodies. So social brain theory basically says that brains became larger in size as a consequence of cognitive demands that were associated with social life and the formation of larger social groups, greater complexity of interactions. And then those cognitive demands had to be supported by brain tissue, basically. And social brain theory is something that has been out since about 1998. And it's supported in some cases. It's not supported in other cases. And we're interested in using ants as a model to test social brain theory for the reason that they have extraordinary collective intelligence. And we're interested in understanding the impact of that collective intelligence on the evolution of the brain. So the species that we're interested in studying are species that are both extraordinarily complex socially and those that are more basic in their social life. And we contrast brain structure and metabolism and so forth in these different sister species. And by making those kinds of comparisons, we feel we can understand something about the factors that compelled social brain evolution.
Very cool. So how many species of ants are there on Earth, roughly?
Well, identified, there are about 12,000 or so. And the estimates are that there may be upwards of 20,000 species.
Wow, that's amazing. So and which species specifically are you studying now?
Well, let me give you an example of these contrasts that we make in levels of social complexity and how we use that to test social brain theory. One of our favorite ants to work with, and one that we've done some recent work with, is an ant called the Australian or Australasian weaver ant. And weaver ants are absolutely remarkable. They form these huge colonies in the canopy of trees in northern Australia, up in Queensland, for example. And they're called weaver ants because they nest in trees and they pull together the leaves of trees. They secure them in place, and other ants will come forward with a larva, which is basically an immature ant. And the larvae are capable of producing silk. And the worker ants will hold a larva in their mandibles and shuttle the larva back and forth between the leaves that are anchored in place by other groups of workers, sometimes form living chains in order to pull the leaves together. And then that moving back and forth of the larvae and touching its head to the leaves that need to be held together, that results in basically the construction of a nest. So that's very, very complex behavior for an invertebrate. And it doesn't have a leader. There's nobody that is barking out orders and, you know, telling Doris to go stand over there or Madge to go stand over there or pull that lead or whatever. It's all an emergent collective property of the group. And the colonies that they live in are upwards of half a million individuals or so. They're the dominant ant, maybe even the dominant animal in rainforest canopy. So that's a socially complex ant. And for our interest in terms of using these as a model for social brain evolution, we contrast them with a very local species we have in the genus Formica, which is a sister clade to this Australasian weaver ant. They're very closely related genetically, but Formica are the species we study are, they're not terribly exciting to watch. They're not terribly interesting. They don't do that much. They have much smaller colonies, and there's not that much collective intelligence. There's if you put individuals together and you look at what the cooperative work product is from group action, it's really not that different than what just a couple of individuals can do. So it's making these kinds of contrasts in levels of sociality that we feel will be important in understanding the evolution of the brain.
That's fascinating. So, yeah, like I said at the beginning, you've been studying ants for about 40 years. What got you interested in studying ants in the first place?
Well, I started out when I was maybe 7 or 8 years old, being very interested in the ocean and marine environments. I was particularly interested in the Rocky Intertidal. And if I think back on the kinds of things that I found interesting, they would be questions of, you know, what we call today community ecology, how animal communities are organized, what the species assemblages are, why you find some species in some areas and not in others. So that interest in the marine environment stayed with me right through college. And in college, I wanted to become an expert on invertebrates. I wanted to know everything that I could possibly learn about invertebrates. And that, of course, brought me to a class in entomology. And I didn't take the class in entomology because I felt particularly interested in insects at that time. But I took it because insects are 97% of all invertebrate life. So I thought if I fancy myself as being an invertebrate biologist, then I should spend something about it. So in that course, I became aware of the writings of Edward O. Wilson, who just a few years earlier had published his first book, The Insect Societies. And in that book, Wilson details the organization of insect societies, the principles that govern insect behavior, and that really resonated with me. And that's really where my interest in social insects came from. And then it was just a matter of time that I started gravitating more toward ants.
Awesome. So are there any insights into human behavior and social structures that can be gleaned from those of ants? And if so, what's the connection?
Well, people have been garnering these insights for a long time, ever since biblical times. People have made comparisons between basically ant behavior and the structure of ant societies and human societies. You probably know the quote from the Bible, go to the ant, thy sluggard, know her ways and be wise. Mm-hmm. So today, we don't so much think about the biblical reference, but there are ecological economists like John Gowdry and Lisa Krall, who are interested in what they call ultra-sociality. Ultra-sociality is a level of social complexity that, according to these ecological economists, has been attained only in human societies and in some species of social insects where the social insects practice agriculture. And that would be certain species of termites that are found in Africa that live in very, very large societies, and leaf-cutting ants or fungus-culturing ants, which are in the New World tropics. And this linkage between agriculture and social evolution, they think, is really key. And one of the key aspects that then brings humans and, let's say, ants together in this model of social evolution is that both have very, very striking division of labor, so that individuals become specialists within society. And it's those specializations then that lead to a new emergence of a new level of social complexity. So in humans, that level of social complexity, what Gowdry and Krall call ultra-sociality, that's something that occurred at the transition to agriculture. So the time of that is debated somewhat, but people would, I think, generally agree that it goes back 7 to 10,000 years, and only in certain parts of the world. But where societies, human societies, became agricultural, you then see this, you know, the emergence of division of labor. And you also then see the formation of city-states and the development of larger social groups. So from if we now relate that to the questions of social brain evolution that we started with. So what happened in human brain evolution that people generally know is that over the past 200,000 years, the size of the human brain just absolutely skyrocketed. Our brains got really, really large, up to the you know, size they are today, which is about 1,350 cubic centimeters or so. And at the time of this transition to agriculture, in the time of the Holocene, so this is about 10,000 years ago, then some anthropologists have evidence that they believe shows that we then lost an area in our brains that's about the size of a tennis ball. So our brains started getting smaller. So in terms of why our brains got larger, so that's classical primate social brain theory, because social is complicated. And if you had to, you know social histories and know who your opponents were and your cooperators were, then you needed more neural support for making those kinds of complex decisions and you know, establishing social bonds and maintaining social bonds in these societies. So one piece of evidence there is that with increase in size of non-human primate societies, you see an increase in the size of the brain. But that's just a, parenthetically, that's also associated with diet as well. So again, getting back to 10,000 years ago, so human brains get really large. Then at the time of the advent of agriculture, they start to get small. So how do we study that? So that's tough to do in humans because all this stuff happened in the past. And you can look at skeletal remains and you can measure cranial capacities and you can make some educated guesses as to what the size of societies were and what social life was like. But in ants, we can actually pull out species that have been in environments that have favored different kinds of traits, different environments. Societies differ in size, they differ in the extent of division of labor and so forth. So that's why we think ants are a really great model for looking at these kinds of questions, because we have a whole diverse array of species right in front of us that we can study.
That's so interesting. Thank you. I'm interested to hear more about how ants communicate with one another and what this communication enables them to do. Can you elaborate on this?
Sure. So social networking is something that, you know, ants have done for millions of years before there was Facebook. And social networking basically involves contact with individuals, exchange of information. Largely that information is chemical. There are these chemical compounds that are on the bodies of ants that are called cuticular hydrocarbons. And these vary in their nature in different species and on different individuals. And there's a lot of evidence to show that they're very important in the recognition of nest mates. Other chemicals are very important in cooperative food finding and food retrieval or in defensive context. So the language of ants is really one of chemistry, and there's a diversification of chemicals, which are called pheromones. You've probably heard that term before. And these pheromones largely form the basis of social life because they're the regulators of social interaction.
Great, yeah. So I read something earlier about something called mushroom bodies in the brains of these mm-hmm. ants. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah. Right. So if we go back to what ants teach us about human brain evolution. So in human brains, we have a compartmentalization to the brain. And you have regions that are associated with language and reason, regions that are associated with vision and object recognition or facial recognition. Hand movement recognition and so forth. So what we have is a mosaic brain, and that mosaicism of the brain reflects selection for different compartments that have different kinds of functions, and many of those functions are social. So in the human brain, we have something called the neocortex, and it's this expansion of the neocortex that was so important in the evolution of human brain size in general. And people look at the neocortex as being the seat of our intelligence. So ants have not a cortex, but they have something called mushroom bodies, and genetic evidence suggests that the arthropod mushroom bodies, remember, insects are arthropods, and arthropods have a brain that's structured pretty much like an insect brain. So these mushroom bodies have been shown genetically to go back, you know, literally hundreds of millions of years. So that genetic evidence says that the mushroom bodies may have in some way been the precursor tissues for the cortex of the vertebrate brain. So in insects, mushroom bodies are the centers of memory, the centers of learning, higher sensory integration, and so forth. And they were discovered in the middle of the 19th century by a French researcher named Dujardin. And he thought that they were, you know, seats of intelligence, and he and others made some comparisons among different species like beetles or ants and honeybees and so forth. And what they found was that ants and honeybees had the largest mushroom bodies of all of these insect species that they had looked at. So then that was really the beginnings of, you know, thinking about things like social brain theory. Why is it that the mushroom bodies are so large, especially if they're the seats of intelligence in a honeybee brain or an ant brain? Then if we study mushroom body evolution, then maybe that tells us something also about the evolution of intelligence.
That's fascinating. Yeah, thank you. So I'm also just curious about, you work at Boston University, correct? And I'm curious about just sort of the day-to-day goings-on in your lab, what it's like. You have colleagues working with you and grad students, right? And do you have just a bunch of ant colonies in your lab, or do you go into the field to study ants?
Well, first, I can sum up what goes on in the lab from my perspective as being total bliss. Mm-hmm. It's we have a wonderful group of graduate students and undergraduates and a postdoc who's supported on a Marie Curie fellowship. She is from Spain. And everybody makes contributions to push forward our research agenda in their own way with their own kind of signature science. And yes, we do have cultures of ants in the lab. Some of them are tropical, some of them are local. And yes, we do go into the field and study ants in the field and make collections and so forth. And in outside of the lab, we have a network of collaborators that includes people within our department, includes people at Harvard University, includes people at Providence College, University of Arizona, Field Museum of Chicago. So we have a great deal of people that we work with that are world-class scientists, and it's just outstanding having the opportunity to work with these people.
That's wonderful. So is there any way that our listeners can learn more about or support the research you're doing?
Well, to learn more about what we do, you could just go on to the Boston University website, go to the Department of Biology, and go to the Ecology, Behavior, and Evolution program or the Neurobiology program, and you'll find me listed there, and you can click on my name, and you'll find references, citations to a number of recent articles that we've published and a general statement of our research mission. And you can also our collaborators by looking at the co-authors on those papers. In terms of supporting our work, I guess what I'd ask is that people think more generally about supporting science in general. We live in a very unfortunate time of a post-truth society, and we have to confront things that people call alternative facts. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very depressing. It's very disheartening. And so I think people should really push their support towards science in general and recognize all of the benefits of scientific thinking and the ability of science to answer the most pressing questions that we have.
Very well put. That's great advice. Thank you so much for coming on Animal Voices today, Dr. Traniello, and sharing these fascinating insights with us. It's been great to have you.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
You've been listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, on unceded Coast Salish territories. Please join us here next Friday, where Jen and Allison will be back from their trip to New York at the AR conference. I'm sure they're going to have some really exciting news for all of you. We here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. Visit our website at animalvoices.org, where you can stream past shows or download them as podcasts. You can also see our show blog there with detailed links and subscribe to us on iTunes. Stay in touch with us on Facebook, facebook.com/Animal Voices Vancouver, and on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. We are currently looking for volunteers to produce, co-host, operate the control room, help with website maintenance and social media, and more. If you have skills and any interest in any of these areas as well as a passion for animal advocacy, please do drop us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. Training will be provided. Now we'll leave you with a song. This is Esperanza Spalding performing Little Fly. Did you have anything to say on that, Elise?
Yeah, I just wanted to say this is one of my absolute favorites. I love this song. I love Esperanza Spalding. I think I'm a little biased being a violinist. She did this with a string trio, and it's just beautiful. Wow. But yeah, the reason I picked it is because it is called Little Fly. It's she based the lyrics off a poem by William Blake, who is I think a 19th century poet. Mm-hmm. And something about this poem like makes me choke up every time I read it. It's just very touching about his experience with a little fly. So yeah, it's a beautiful song.
Awesome. And thank you for listening to Animal Voices today. And remember to be kind to the animals.